Welcome to the New Books in Popular Culture podcast. My name is Matt Sinkowitz. I'm Assistant Professor of Communication and International Studies at Boston College, and I am the new host of this channel. I'll have a co-host joining me sometimes, and sometimes he'll be taking over the show by himself. That's Nick Marks of Colorado State. He's not on today, but you'll probably be hearing from him shortly if you subscribe to the channel. If you're interested, if you have suggestions, questions about the podcast, please send me a tweet at Media Studied, MediaStudied. If there's a book that you want talked about, or if you have questions about this week's podcast, please feel free to send me a tweet. We have a guest today on the show, Professor Patrick Burkhardt, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M. And he has a new book coming out this January from MIT Press. It's called Pirate Politics, The New Information Policy Contest. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be with you.
So, Patrick, this is your second book, and both of them deal with these concerns of intellectual property rights. Can you tell us how you came to be sort of interested in the subject?
Absolutely. Well, if you count from Digital Music Wars, it's actually the third book, and there's the reason I mention it is because there's continuity through all three, I think. I was real active in local music scenes and community media scenes as a young person, and through college and grad school, participated in community media like college radio and cable access television, and really grew up around creative cultures and participative cultures that involved media. And out of grad school, my friend Tom McCourt and I realized that there was a movement afoot in response to Napster, particularly, that really could work as a diminishing factor on a lot of the music scenes that we both loved and enjoyed, particularly local media, local radio. And so we endeavored to do an overall survey of the music industry and wrote Digital Music Wars, Ownership and Control of the Celestial Jukebox. And it was a way of looking at how the music industry's really remapped from an old line, traditional, production and distribution outfit to much more of a software and e-business based model. And this is old news today, but when we were working on the project in 2004, we were really just seeing the early emergence of music industry participation in online music distribution. Fast forwarding to 2010, the celestial jukebox model of distribution of digital media had firmly taken hold, and online participatory cultures were under attack, concerted attack, by the major music labels and Hollywood studios. And so my second book project, Music and Cyber Liberties, was a chance to look at how music fans in particular were, and other kinds of participatory fan cultures were responding to some of the incredible power grabs in the area of copyright and software patents and other very powerful legal mechanisms for consolidating digital markets, and looking at how fans and indie labels and indie music groups were organizing in response to the corporate celestial jukebox model. And because it was a U.S.-centric study, it could only go so far in describing and explaining some of what we all came to notice around 2009 when the Pirate Bay community in Sweden transformed itself into a political party in order to challenge some of the same processes going on in Europe. So as soon as I finished music in Cyber Liberties, I realized I had to go see what was going on in Sweden, because here the kids were taking back their participatory cultures in ways that many of us couldn't have imagined 10 years ago.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit or talk us through the Celestial Jukebox model and let us know how the Pirates Bay sort of served as a reaction to it?
Sure. Celestial Jukebox model describes how the music and entertainment industries together presented the case for a commercial internet distribution platform. But they called it the information, it was paired with this notion of information superhighway that promoted the privatization of the internet and its deregulation in the 1990s. So Celestial Jukebox was really a PR campaign term for the promise of a digitally distributed media environment, such as what we see now. But what Tom and I took pains to do in Digital Music Wars book was to show how it's created around a legal and a technical infrastructure that are very much intermeshing. And on the technical side, you have digital rights management, which locks down copies of licensed or licensed copies of software or media. And its legal counterpart is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which provides special legal protections for media owners and licensors who use copy protections. And there's a whole list of technologies that plug into DRM in one way or another. But it was that infrastructure combined with business as usual on the ownership side of media production and distribution that leads us to the Celestial Jukebox, which is basically a monopoly or oligopoly of services that are catered to providing on-demand access to video and music and books, etc. So a very locked-down, corporatized model of digital distribution, very much on an older model of pay-per-view, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So that's the outline of the Celestial Jukebox, and it really locks out participation from non-major label and media monopolists. And so the Pirate Bay, among other places, gathered together people who were anxious to bypass digital distribution on the official model. And the Pirate Bay community became a place that where hackers and file sharers and people without access to digital media through the Celestial Jukebox model gathered and shared tips and tricks for getting access to unavailable or extremely expensive material, books and music and movies particularly, to the dismay of the culture industries who were all in on the Celestial Jukebox model for the most part.
Now you you described it as people who didn't have access, and I'm sure that's not what the corporate side of this tends to say, right? They say it's people who could have it, but they don't want to pay for it. Is it a fair? I mean, is there truth to both sides of that, or is that really?
Oh, of course, yeah. Of course there is. However, and you may have noticed this yourself in your field work and in your international experiences, there's a great deal of content that we have access to in the United States online that is IP blocked. The domains are international domains are blocked from receiving a lot of the online content, such as what you might find on a Netflix or in an iTunes store. And I think there are plenty of studies of piracy which suggest strongly that people who trade files often do so in order in the States, at least, they do so in order to decide what they want to purchase later. So they're tasting. But in international contexts, a lot of these catalog items aren't even available for legitimate purchase. So you have to use other means to acquire them.
Now, from an American perspective, sort of being steeped in our notions of intellectual property, what's maybe the most amazing to a sort of somebody who's new to this story is the idea that something like the Pirate Bay would ultimately be the springboard for a real political party. In some ways, this might seem to an outside perspective to be sort of a really limited issue to be building your political platform on, but in fact they've been quite successful in doing so. How did this happen? How did the Pirate Bay go from being a place to trade movies and music to an actual political platform?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I was driven by this question starting 3 years ago, and I really thought not only why did it happen at all, but why did it happen in Sweden of all places? But that's where the servers were hosted for the Pirate Bay, and the servers were the target of police raids in 2009, I want to say. And basically disrupted under the behest of U.S. copyright owners who were working through diplomatic and international channels to basically take the Pirate Bay offline for good. And it was the confluence of the Pirate Bay raids and the passage of several European-wide directives relating to intellectual property online, as well as some national-level laws that permitted police surveillance of international internet traffic, that really those three things together combined in such a way that young people who were paying attention were able to discern an attack against an internet sharing culture that had been flourishing for the last 10 years or more since Sweden went online and, in a big way with broadband infrastructure development. And the cyber culture in Sweden is quite strong, and it's quite intertwined with the creative classes and the creative cultures in the country. It's a very cosmopolitan and high-tech techno culture, I call it. And you know, all of these organizations, there were a lot of organizations involved, but it was more like a civil society movement that developed in response as a way to protect, you know, this cultural field that had been developing in Sweden for 10 or 15 years or more. Nancy Bain, by the way, has written some interesting stuff on the Swedish music and film scenes. And the formalization of the Pirate Party of Sweden from the interest groups and affinity groups surrounding the Pirate Bay institutionalized the Pirate Party. And at first they were gunning just for symbolic appearances on local and municipal ballots in order to make a standing and demonstrate that they were actually engaged, interested citizens who had something to say about information policy in the European Union. And I think they really got attention when they won a seat on the European Parliament shortly after forming, and suddenly found themselves participating in European Union level negotiations over region-wide copyright and trade policy related to the European common market. And they very quickly went from, I would say, a milieu into a transnational operation. And very quickly after that, we started seeing other pirate parties in the region springing up, beginning in Germany, where they attained a lot more national level traction and participated very broadly in the state level elections in the last 5 years. And now we see over 50 pirate parties in Europe, some of which are more institutionalized than others, but all of them are interconnected. And they're sharing information and news and gossip about the changing shape of the technoculture in Europe and how to engage against some of the new threats that they perceive to not only file sharing, but privacy and access to information online. So they've really diversified their scope in the last few years and transnationalized. And remember, this is a youth movement. Most of the participants in pirate politics in any formal way are kids. We might think of them as kids, you know, mostly under the age of 20.
Hmm. And that seems to be a challenge for a political movement, though. Is there a sense that the parties will grow and that'll cease to be the case? That as sort of people who are young members now mature, they'll remain with the party? Or is it something that needs to kind of constantly renew itself from the younger groups?
That's a good question. Great question. My sense is that the younger people who were instigators will probably continue with it. Of course, you know, parliamentary politics in some of the smaller countries of the world can be quite choppy in terms of the relative successes and failures of parties across the political spectrum. I try to avoid that kind of question and focus instead on some of the historical continuities between the pirate politics and ecological politics, which I think shares a lot of affinities with this movement. And the connections have been drawn before between cyber liberties and digital rights and ecology. James Boyle in particular, a law scholar, has written quite extensively about the philosophical connections between preservation of a cultural commons and the preservation of the natural environment. So I look for those connections where I can find them between ecological thinking of the Green Party style and cultural environmentalism of the Pirate Party style. And I do see quite a few similarities. And one similarity in particular, I thought I might mention to you, because when I stumbled upon it in Sweden, doing my some of my research there on the legal traditions of that country, it became clear to me right away that there is a linkage between cultural heritage and the legal traditions of ancient Swedes and contemporary Swedes. And one of the linkages that I discovered is this notion of allemansrätten, which means every man's right to roam and wander the countryside of Sweden without being stopped by a private property owner. And it's true that in that country and many other Nordic countries, I should say three other Nordic countries, and even the UK, there are public rights of access to private property such that wandering and hiking and skiing and boating private lands and waters aren't illegal activities, as long as you're not despoiling them and as long as you aren't invading anybody else's privacy in the process. And I see pirate politics as pushing this tradition of every man's right to roam into cyberspace. And if you look at some of the arguments that the pirates make with respect to accusations of theft, for example, of intellectual property, you can trace a lot of the, if not the rhetoric, certainly the implications of their arguments about sharing culture to the ancient traditions of sharing land.
I mean, it's a wonderful metaphor and an excellent connection. It gets, of course, complicated, as you note, throughout the book, in that it does not remain sort of a Swedish-only issue. That, of course, a lot of the intellectual property at question is foreign. Much of it is American. And America has been sort of notoriously heavy-handed in its efforts to influence the rest of the world. Could you talk to me about the kind of the coming together of that local Swedish ethic that you described so nicely? And then the idea of sort of America sending over people to defend its interests.
Well, one of the reasons we know what we know about American lobbying, and I should say North American U.S. lobbying of the European Union states in the areas of intellectual property, we know because of WikiLeaks. And we know what we know because whistleblowers have essentially alerted activist communities to the back channel ways that the culture industries in the United States operate and influence their trading partners and negotiators in around the rest of the world. So I draw upon WikiLeaks diplomatic cable dumps in a couple of places in order to show that the pressure on the Pirate Bay specifically was more or less an executive branch exertion straight across the Atlantic. But more generally still, I think that when you look at the different European directives that relate to copyright and relate to things like data retention, which affects the ability of online portal users, for instance, to remain anonymous or to have their privacy protected. When you look at the diminishment of cyber liberties that are being baked into the new trade agreements that affect North America and Europe and Southeast Asia, you see that at an executive level, there's a negotiation away of privacy, free speech, and access to knowledge and culture, because trade agreements are essentially containers for multilateral and plurilateral reforms to intellectual property laws. And in pirate politics, I take some trouble and time in the book to elaborate how there are there's what I call a ratchet and a fulcrum effect to intellectual property laws. Every new trade agreement ratchets up the level of protections available for copyright owners while diminishing the rights of non-owners. There's also a trade fulcrum that I describe as exerting pressure, negotiating pressure on smaller countries and smaller coalitions by the United States and our trade and our economic allies. And so through a combination of trade negotiations and incremental movements and the maximalization of copyright protections, there's a globalization effect of stronger and stronger protections for owners and weaker legal recourses for consumers of culture, which is the rest of us, which is all of us. It gets a little bit wonkish, but if you look at the at the trade level, you see quite clearly that there is an imbalance between Hollywood and the rest of the world, and that they are exploiting this imbalance aggressively through trade negotiations and also increasingly through the police and international policing agencies, which have been delegated final responsibilities for enforcing a lot of infringement claims.
In regards to the Swedish context, I mean, is there a strong political movement there that sort of echoes that American very tough intellectual property standard? Is that where the Pirate Party comes from, or is it mostly trying to argue against North America?
Well, make no mistake, Sweden is officially allied with the United States and other European countries who are net exporters of intellectual property. Sweden and France and the UK are the only three European countries that export more in terms of economic value in cultural goods and services than what they import. And so on paper, Sweden looks like an IP maximalist like the United States. And formally speaking, the Swedish government has behaved just as you would expect them to behave as a net exporter. So, you know, the pirates are counter-hegemonic in their own country as well as internationally speaking, and they see an alternative system altogether for handling intellectual property claims. I mean, one of the key platform planks of the pirates is the reduction of term of copyrights, you know, from what it is now, which is beyond the lifespan of the average human being, to 10 years. They also have other ideas about restricting copyright ownership to promote the incorporation of software patents, for example, more quickly into new innovations and making new derivative works out of protected intellectual property. They're looking for practical ways to encourage innovation. So they're not rejecting entirely the property rights claims of media industries. In fact, they themselves, many pirates, are employed in the IP sector, be it software or web media or music or whatever. They just want to tweak the terms so that the monopolists are forced to let go a little bit and create a little bit more slack in the system.
I think many listeners might be somewhat surprised to hear that Sweden's actually a net exporter in terms of IP. What are they exporting so much of?
A lot of film, a lot of music, a lot of software, and they have also a very flourishing small and medium-sized sector of enterprises producing media. And these are mostly centered around the major cities and university towns. But, you know, as a smaller country, they're forced to export for growth. And, you know, they do so as well in sectors that require a lot of engineering knowledge. So automotive, aerospace, chemical, et cetera. You know, Sweden's right up there in terms of net exporters of goods and services that rely on engineering knowledge.
Now, one of the things I like so much about this book is that it simultaneously offers sort of this very clear history of this really interesting phenomena, but it's also rather theoretically rich. And I'd like to at least take a moment out of our discussion here to give you an opportunity to talk through a little bit of this theory, particularly the theory of communicative action, which is sort of one of the guiding lenses through which you understand pirate politics. Can you tell us a little bit about this theory, and then how does it inform your work about the pirates?
Sure. I'll mention two things at the top. And one is that I was influenced by new social movement theory as a student, and particularly that form of new social movement theory that derives from European continental philosophy and sociology. So I was looking for a way to revitalize a discourse on European new social movements that began, I would say, to really develop theoretically in an interesting way in the 80s. And I was looking for a case that might update this new social movement theory. And I also draw, by the way, from Alberto Melucci, who wrote a very influential text called Nomads of the Present, which I think shares a lot of similarities with new social movement theory of the continental style. So I am really working with Frankfurt School ideas that have been updated by Jürgen Habermas, and whereas most media literature uses Habermas and the theory of communicative action to describe the liberal public sphere as a key construct, I really focus more on what Habermas pulls over directly from Horkheimer and Adorno and Marcuse and some of the older school Frankfurt School thinkers, particularly this notion of cultural colonization of the life world. I find to be a very appropriate metaphor and explanation for what we see on a macro level in terms of the conversion of the internet over, from a real life world to much more of a commercial delivery platform for media companies, locked out for other uses, single purpose, single functionality, and the theory of communicative action describes the life world as basically being a communicative resource for us, where we're able to develop our identities, find social solidarities, develop our communicative competencies, and grow as well-grounded, socially grounded people. And that life world is perpetually under some erosion or attack by systemic pressures that at the root of it are responsible for attacking the life world due to the need for the system to grow. So the growth imperative of capitalism and all of its attendant functions. And I'm speaking very broadly now, but I look in very specific ways at which the pirates identify cultural colonization of the life world, and then they attach a policy objective to each risk that they discover and work on it very, very attentively in order to protect what they see as a vital resource for communication in the information age. So I describe the pirates as essentially behaving like an environmentalist organization on behalf of online culture. And we see many of the same colonization threats recognized by ecologists from previous decades, describing the same colonization pressures that are impinging on the natural environment.
And what are those pressures?
Well, obviously, at this stage in the game, it's global warming and carbon emissions. And I would also say that radiation from nuclear energy is another one of those issues. Radiation and nuclear power, by the way, was one of those technologies and risks that divided the early ecological movement into ecology, deep ecology, and environmentalist strains, because environmentalists tend to find technological solutions to human problems, whereas ecologists are much more skeptical about technological solutions to man-made problems.
And so, what's the what is the parallel there with the Pirate Party? How does it match up?
I hear a train. Do you?
I do. It's all right though. We still hear you loud and clear.
That's great. I live very close to an old form of technology.
Oh, there it is.
The diesel engine.
It's coming. destroying the atmosphere as we speak.
Well, let me preface my answer by saying that the pirates have not yet fissured in a way that would allow us really to see what, you know, a pragmatic version of their purist philosophy might look like. But if we were to speculate, we might have internet purists who say that no forms of domestic state surveillance are legitimate online, that they're all privacy risks inherently. And then you might have some pragmatists who say, hang on a minute, you know, there are some legitimate reasons for the state to be surveilling online communication. So that might be one fraction point. Mm.
Does it seem as though the future of the party, at least the way you just described it there, is more along that privacy angle as opposed to the intellectual property? Have they been melded successfully? I mean, they seem to me to be conceptually separate in some ways, but they're working to bring them together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think that the activist work on cyber liberties that the world reads from Lessig and others implicitly perhaps constructs a tripartite version of digital rights: free speech, privacy, and access to information and culture. And that structure, that unity of digital rights, as I call it, has held up, at least in U.S. discourse about cyber liberties. And in fact, when you find activist organizations from civil society groups, for instance, going to lobby on behalf of privacy, now, you know, they end up also defending those same proposals and bills that promote other cyber liberties as well. So the movement really hangs together around those three. But it's easy to see how, you know, there could be conflicting impetuses between privacy and free speech, for instance, or between access to information and privacy. And I'll just offer one example, which is a very mainstream example in Europe right now. A prominent European parliamentarian called a year and a half ago for the right to be forgotten in Europe. In other words, as a user of Facebook or Twitter or perhaps another online service that persistently stores your identity, shouldn't we be able, as consumers and citizens of the information society, to access a big delete button, which would effectively erase our participation, evidence of our participation in one of these communities? Many Europeans seem to think that's essential for digital privacy these days. But what does that do for a historian's right to access the historical record, right? Mm-hmm. If people are deleting themselves from digital history, doesn't that, you know, threaten the retrievability of history from a historian's perspective? So we can come up with a matrix, probably, of potential conflicts between the three elements of digital freedoms. And I try to do that as much as possible in the conclusion of Pirate Politics.
It seems as though that the entry point for the Pirate party had everything to do with the political system in Sweden, and that we don't have a similar parliamentary system. There's no easy access to that sort of high level of power that they were able to get from so kind of a limited perspective. Is there a pathway for this kind of thinking to become more mainstream in American politics, or do you think that this is something that has to be done through Europe, at least first, if not only?
Yeah, well, I think the United States is a generation behind the Europeans in terms of the level of public debate and deliberation about information policy issues. I mean, we really haven't touched it since we deregulated thoroughly in the mid-90s. Starting to become salient as we learn more and more about the involvement of the state in perpetual and seemingly universal panspectric surveillance. And this is a topic, by the way, that pirate politics doesn't address. But because we don't have access to parliamentary negotiations, such as what your Europeans enjoy, we are really basically crippled in terms of taking any political decisions about cyber liberties right now. I mean, we can't even pass a budget in this country. So I find it difficult to imagine the United States innovating on the pirate model. Now, Canada is another story, and the Pirate Party of Canada is a very interesting case worth a great deal of new research. And also in the English-speaking world, the Pirate Party UK is quite active and influential. But I'm afraid we're sunk politically as a source of new ideas or even any real action.
Are there any lessons that us poor trapped Americans can take from the success of the Pirate Party?
Yeah, I mean, I think the lessons are that alternative visions of the information society are not only possible, but they're also being implemented by activists, young activists, and the fact that a generation of internet users who have been, disparaged by older people as being inactive and disinterested and detached, they're really trying to take over their parents' generation of leadership in the area of information policy, and they see the internet as being their domain, where their influence and their interests are at stake. And I think that we can always learn from people like that. And even if it's not, it might need to be more direct action and activism from pirates in the U.S., but in order to get things done. But we can certainly take motivation, if not instruction, from what's going on in Sweden and Germany.
Mm. Is there a hacktivist element to what is going on in Sweden and Germany, or is it able to go through that standard political process so it's less necessary?
Right. Well, I think hacktivism is not as necessary as it had been, and that's one of the interesting things about the maturation of this movement into political engagement with the formal system. But hacktivism, I think, always plays a role because, hackers are tinkering and innovating with software code as speech acts for making political statements. And these statements are becoming bolder, and they're becoming more complicated, and they're finding broader global audiences. So there will always be a role for hacktivism, even in Sweden.
Kind of back to a previous question, but if there is, let's say I'm totally persuaded by your perspective that this is the pirate parties are sort of anti-colonial in all the best ways, they're ecological in all the best ways. On the micro level, is there something less than hacktivism that I can do? Is there something, is there any action that we can take as individuals that's sort of not putting ourselves at risk or illegal?
Sure. I mean, I think becoming educated about, for instance, the Trans-Pacific Partnership might be a good exercise for all of us right about now, because it's another example of one of these plurilateral agreements negotiated in secret by negotiators who've all signed non-disclosure agreements. The only reason we're learning about it is through WikiLeaks. It's the most illegitimate, undemocratic, stuff we've seen since the ACTA. The more people who become aware of not only the negotiations of these particular agreements, but, the underlying rationales for them and why our politicians are actually pursuing these and allowing them to be negotiated behind our backs. I mean, this is all information we need to be familiar with, regardless of the fact that, we can't vote digital rights up and down in a congressional session. We can still do things that affect digital rights, perhaps more indirectly.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you so much for these considered answers. You've offered quite a few possible areas for future research that scholars could take up. Are you yourself going to be pursuing this project further, or are you looking somewhere else with your next project?
I would love to go back and take a look at some of the smaller and younger pirate parties, maybe in Finland and perhaps in Eastern European countries. So at this moment, I'm exploring ways to do that, and I'm welcoming and encouraging expressions of interest in collaborating further.
So what you're saying is that we, if we want to advance this effort, we could also write a grant for you to apply to.
Would you please?
Well, if anybody's out there and then is interested, Patrick's looking for both collaborators and support. But we very much appreciate your time here, Patrick. We look forward to reading the book when it comes out. It's coming out this January from MIT Press, right? January 2014.
Right.
Okay, so that'll be available from MIT Press, and I'm sure you'll be able to find it on all sorts of other distribution outlets. Patrick Burkhardt of Texas A&M University, thank you very much for the interview.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Matt.